access number 27811, Major Richard Wilson, Real 18. Now, we're talking about the new colonels, Lieutenant Colonel John Dimmock, who took over. Mm. Now, you had differences of opinion with him, without being libelous in any way, but if you see what I mean. What did go wrong between you? Are you able to comment on why you didn't get on so well?
Well, I don't know. Perhaps it was just a clash of personalities. Is probably the easiest way of of putting it. I just didn't get on very well with him.
Did that impact on the way you ran your company, or the way he? Did it get in the way?
No, not really, because it was very much. Rather like Malheur had been, it was very much a platoon and company commander's war, and could have been rather frustrating, possibly from a commanding officer's point of view. It didn't alter my way of operating, whether that was good or bad, but it didn't make any. Difference, from that point of view.
And what were you actually doing? What do you remember of the operations?
I suppose it was probably not unlike what's going on in Iraq today, in that you've got a mass of sort of different political factions. And I suppose what we were trying to do is just to keep the whole thing quiet, so that the political process could come to some justifiable end. So one was really just sort of keeping the peace. We must have been operating to quite a bit of intelligence. And if there were sort of known terrorists, political people making trouble, then we would do our best to pick them up, and all the rest of it. It was a very sort of phony period of military history, quite honestly. And I suppose I can best describe it by describing one or two incidents that took place. I mean, I sent a platoon out one afternoon to do a cordon and search of an area in Sheikh Othman. And a cordon and search is when you put a perimeter around an area and you then search all the houses in that area to see if you can find arms, wanted men, or whatever it might be. And I suppose they spent the whole afternoon up there, and then they came, that platoon came back, reported in to me that all was well and everyone was back. And we were going out again at about 7:45. By which time, of course, it's dark, because it gets dark in Aden about 6 o'clock or where it is. And we were about to move off when the platoon commander came to me and said, one of my men is missing. To which, you can imagine, I was absolutely horrified. Anyhow, we got in my Land Rover and we rushed back to Sheikh Othman. And we went to where this man had been in the afternoon, and to our utter amazement, he was still standing there. And he hadn't heard the cordon being withdrawn. Whether he'd gone to sleep or what, I don't know. But anyhow, there he was, and it totally amazing, because it was a very volatile area, and the fact and how the Arab population hadn't gone and knocked him off, I don't know. But I personally, as a company commander, and I can assure you, the platoon commander, were very, very relieved Indeed, but this just shows you this, you know, the sort of things that can happen. On another occasion, we were—I had a Land Rover with sort of behind me and the driver was a whole lot of was some sort of decks in, and I had a high seat so that I could see, have a better view of what was going on around me when I was being driven. And we were patrolling, just doing a routine patrol one day at night, when I heard what I thought was a grenade bouncing down the road towards us. So we weren't going very, very fast. So we all left the Land Rover, which was still in gear, so it sort of disappeared down the road. There was a sort of blinding flash, and the grenade went off. And then we rushed round the corner and picked up what we thought was a chap who'd actually thrown the grenade. But whether he had or not, I don't know, but he was never brought to court, that I do know. So while that was going on, the driver chased after to pick up his Land Rover, which was still sort of jerking down the road. And we continued the patrol. But, you know, that was a sort of a couple of instances of our sort of, you know, our life out there.
Was there much sniping?
There was quite a bit of sniping, and unfortunately they were quite clever with their sniping because they used to do it from the mosques. And, you know, the minarets of the mosques were sort of used as sniping positions, and on the whole, we didn't go into the mosques because obviously that would have even turned the neutral population against us. So we tended not, unless we were actually chasing somebody we knew had shot at us, and he went into a mosque, then I think we would have gone in then. But on the whole, we tried not to go into the mosque, because as we know from Iraq now how touchy it gets. And I did have one quite interesting thing happen to me. I had a driver, I can't remember what his name was, I'm sad to say, but who I think has got shell shock. Now, there's a lot of interpretations as to what shell shock is. But this, we were up at Sheikh Othman one day, and we had a small company forward headquarters that we were operating for, and I had patrols out all over the town. And I wanted to move from A to B, and I shouted for my driver, and he couldn't be found. And he was eventually found cowering under a bush, and he had mentally gone. He'd had enough. We'd been, you know, shot at, grenaded, and all these things, and he just couldn't take any more. And he was sent back to base, and then I think eventually shipped back to UK. But it was a very interesting one. You know, he just couldn't. And nothing against it. I'm not being critical of him in any way. He could just take no more. His mind had enough. But that in the whole of my career is the only time I've seen that happen. But otherwise it was sort of, you know, fairly routine. And I mean, another instance, to sort of give you sort of things we were doing there, I think the Queen's Dragoon Guards were in Aden at the same time, and they'd been up country, and they were coming down through Sheikh Othman to return to their barracks. And And we had, as it were, picketed the road to give them safe journey through. And this was always rather a dodgy time because you were fairly sort of static and all the rest of it. And if people got excited, you know, you were an easy target. And I got on my wireless and told the Dragoon guards to come through. And their CO, for some reason, and I can't remember what his name is, was rather slow in giving, I thought anyhow, in giving the order for them to come through. And I couldn't get them to move. And I had all my soldiers on the ground, for which I was worried about them. For some reason, I obviously couldn't get back to battalion headquarters. There must have been a radio problem. So I got in my Land Rover and I roared back to 2 battalion headquarters, which only took me about 5 or 6 minutes. And I walked into the ops room, and the CO was standing there with another officer who I hadn't seen before. And I rushed in, very hot-headed, and said, "Who the hell is commanding the Dragoon guards? And can't he make a bloody decision to get his troops on the move?" To which the colonel turned to me and said, "Oh, Richard, you haven't met Colonel so-and-so commanding the Dragoon Guards, have you?" rather end of conversation and the rest of it. But anyhow, they did get on the move after that and come through. But you know, that's a sort of silly incident of things that went on. But I personally was, I just wanted to get my pickets in before anybody had a go at them. But that was the sort of life it was. All quite exciting. Wonderful company commander's job. Fascinating.
You were enjoying it then?
Oh, yes, very much so.
Any particular subalterns you recall? Or
well, I'm not going to mention the subaltern who was the... who left his soldier behind. Suffice to say, he went on to command a battalion of another regiment and is still very much with us and still a friend of mine. But I think it'd be knowing that this might get into public possible, I think I won't mention...
Anything you do want to mention, just, if you relied on or were good
I had a splendid... I had a splendid lot of subalterns.
What makes a good subaltern, do you think? You know, for you, what were you looking for in your subalterns?
What was I looking for? I was looking for an officer who I could give orders to, and know that they were going to be carried out correctly. I was looking for a subaltern who, even if you'd given orders to, and then when he got up to where he was going, he found the situation different to what you'd told him, would then take his own initiative and get on with the job. I'm looking for a subaltern who was popular with his troops and led from the front. And that, I think, is really, what it's all about. If you had a platoon, if you started to hear rumblings in a platoon, and they were clearly not 100% happy, then where do you look? You look obviously to the commander to see if there's something going wrong. Whether it be at section level, platoon level, or be at company level.
And what about your CSM and senior NCOs? How did you get on with that? Do you remember?
My CSM was a splendid man. He's now dead, sadly. But he was very good, and a right hand man. I mean, he'd probably be back in camp a lot of the time because it was necessary to have somebody back there to make sure that when they did get back to camp, that all was well, and the men themselves didn't have to worry about anything. They were fed, watered, they got the rest, etc. So you had to have a small element back in camp. So you can sort of say that I had a sort of tactical headquarters, which was myself, quite often my second in command, my radio operator, my driver, probably my batman. And then back in camp, you would have possibly the company sergeant major, the colour sergeant, etc. Although a lot of the time, the company sergeant major would be up with you. Like any sort of bit of the army, you had sort of G side, which was, as I say, myself and my group, and then you had the Q side, who were back in camp, looking after the administration of the. Of the company.
So it's the CSM and the CQMS who would deal with that?
Yes, the CSM probably quite a lot of the time actually be up with you. I mean, if we happened to have three platoons all going out on operations at the same time, it would be the company sergeant major who would get them on parade and make sure they were all there and the rest of it, and then report to you that the company was ready to move out. And the CQMS would have, if we were going out for 2 or 3 days, would be the one who would make sure that we all had our rations and everything on that side. But it was really life. We were very busy out there. I suspect we could have done with more men. And quite honestly, we were either out on patrol or sleeping, and that was our life. Which was a good thing because there was nothing else to do. I mean, we were in a tented camp on a beach, and there was no at that stage. There was no life anywhere else. There was nothing for the soldiers to do. I'm sure there were film shows in camp, and there would have been a naffy canteen and all that. But we were either working or sleeping. It was as basic as that. And we weren't frightfully secure, really, because we were just on the beach. We must have had a wire fence around us, I suppose, the rest of it. But there were several occasions in which they mortared us from outside, and sort of homemade mortars and things would land in the middle of the camp.
How effective were they?
What, the mortars? I don't think we had any casualties from it. I mean, funnily enough, I've just been reading a book on Aden by, I think, I'm not sure, it wasn't a chap in the National Army Museum or the Imperial War Museum, I can't know which, but he's just done a book on Aden where he gives an incredibly high. Is it Walker? Did Walker write that book? I don't know. He gives that we had an enormous amount of casualties. I can't remember this. I think he puts it in 100 and something. I don't remember any of that. We must have had the odd chap wounded, and we may have had. One or two killed. I can't remember. I can't remember any casualties in my own company, to be quite honest. But that And it's in that same book that he said the Federal Army were on the Jebel Hara before we were. Well, all I can say is that I didn't see any Federal Army up on the Jebel when I got there. But, we must have had a few casualties, but I can't believe that we had casualties into the figures that he puts in his book. But that was our that was our life. After a bit, I mean, it all becomes very routine. On that, but certainly once or twice, you'd move up to Shaveoffman and you'd have your tactical headquarters, and you'd be there for 20 minutes or wherever it is, and then you'd move to somewhere else so that if anybody's going to have a go at you, that you weren't there that long. And once or twice, we did get sniped at and had grenades thrown at us and all that sort of thing. But that's what we were expecting.
So what happens next?
We spent 9 months doing that. By which time it was coming near to the end Aidan packing in altogether, and certainly by then, politically, it had been announced that we were going to withdraw. We handed over to one para, I think I'm right in saying, certainly a para battalion, and I think it was one para, we handed over to, and they lived in that tented camp and did much the same as us for the last 6 months. Before the whole thing.
When did you leave Aidan then? That would be 67, when about? Not sure?
Not sure, no. We withdrew and came back to Tidworth, where we resumed normal training. And I found that a very difficult period.
Now why?
I think because in Aidan we had more work to do and more ground to cover than we could actually cope with. So there was never any problem with finding something for the troops to do. I mean, if anything, we had more than we could cope with. And then you come back to Tidworth and Salisbury Plain and everything, and you sort of sit down and you're suddenly out of internal security type thing, back into European warfare training. And I found it with the not all that good facilities, I didn't think. I found it very difficult to come up with an exciting timetable every day for the troops to do. It may have been because I wasn't sort of very, very good at that, I don't know, but I did find that coming back to the sort of ordinary barrack routine, I found very difficult, and I found it much more difficult to keep my soldiers happy. And we tended, you had more. I mean, in Aidan, I don't think I probably ever had a soldier on a charge. That may have been the odd thing, but you come back to barracks, and then it's all very different because the soldiers are returning to a normal routine as well, and like any bunch of people, they go into Salisbury or wherever it is, and you get the odd fight and all the rest of it, and all that. So people then turn to you and say, oh, you're not keeping your soldiers occupied enough, and all the rest of it. And I found that actually quite difficult, and I think Colonel Dimmock also probably didn't think I was frightfully good at that either. I mean, we had big exercises and things that we worked up to. And
now, what sort of exercises?
We'd go up to Otterburn and do live firing training, sectoral attacks, platoon in the attacks, company in the attacks, etc., etc. And we'd do stamina exercises, a lot of marching and patrolling through the sort of thing that one might have to do if one was operating in a European theatre of war. But I suppose the difference was excitement is the right word, of Aden, where you didn't know what was going to happen from one moment to the next. You can set off from the beach camp and you could be got out on the way, or there's an incident on, there's always something happening, where you then come back to very routine life. I think that was quite difficult to get used to. And then, they'd go off on weekends and things and then come back, and you sort of start, you led a sort of Monday to Friday lifestyle like anybody else, but to a soldier it's not as easy as that, and guards and all the rest of it, and then wasn't long after we got that we then did a huge trooping of the colour for Princess Margaret, and I think we spent 2 months prancing up and down the square getting ready for this. And then on the morning of the great parade, she never turned up. So that went down like a lead balloon, as you can imagine. Apparently she had an ailment of some sort, although one or two people said that she apparently had been seen at a nightclub up to quite late in the morning, but whether that's true or not, I don't know. But anyhow, we'd put an enormous amount of effort into this, and personally, I absolutely lathe the drill square. Not my scene at all. And so it all sort of rather fell on stony ground, because no general can, when you've been doing that sort of thing, can fill the place of somebody like Princess Margaret. So it was a pity. But there we are.
Did the trooping ceremony go ahead?
The ceremony went ahead. Oh yes. I think the Colonel of the Regiment, then was Dick Goodwin. It all went ahead. Oh, certainly. Everybody had been, all the visitors and everybody had been asked. I mean, it all just continued as normal, except the principal player didn't happen to be there. Life was very, very routine. We were part of the parachute brigade in Tidworth, and which was then commanded by Farrow Hockley. We saw quite a bit of him.
What do you think of him?
Well, clearly he was obviously a very great leader of men. I mean, from his history, I think what he's out from the Gloucesters, wasn't he? Imogen. No, clearly a great chap, but a leader of men, and became a quite a considered military historian in his time.
You were part of the brigade, but you weren't parachute troops, were you?
No, no. But we were part. We were a battalion, and I mean, our brigade headquarters was in Aldershot, I think, from what I remember. So I spent. After we came back, I suppose I had another 6 months.